In Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, September 13th, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on artists in times of war. Artists forge from circumstances beyond their control, artists creating beauty from death and destruction, a story of Washington's immigrant community in film. This is the story of Las Muertes Más Bellas del Mundo, the most beautiful deaths in the world. And so today on the show, we have the honor and the pleasure of having with us today Ana Patricia Rodriguez, who is an associate professor of U.S. Latinx and Central American Literatures and the School of Languages, Literatures, and Cultures at the University of Maryland in College Park. Welcome back to the show, Professor Rodriguez.
Thanks again for having me on your show. I look forward to, you know, just engaging with you and the public.
Absolutely. And also joining us today for the first time is Hugo Najera, who's a member of the Yellow House Collective, as well as being a composer and co-producer of the film that I just mentioned. Welcome to the show, Hugo Najera.
Thank you very much, Oscar. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here joining everyone today.
Absolutely. So before we go in depth with today's discussion, I have a clip here from the film that perhaps gives the public a snapshot of what we'll be discussing today. So let's take a listen.
In 1980, El Salvador threw a human grenade into Washington direction. We were the pieces of Spanish-speaking shrapnel flying all over.
Some of the best creativity comes when you're touched by some kind of injustice. You have no choice but to be pissed.
So that was a clip from the most beautiful deaths in the world, Las Muertes Más Bellas del Mundo. So with that clip as our frame of reference, I'll begin with Ana. by seeing if you could tell us more about the most beautiful deaths in the world here.
So the most beautiful deaths in the world, the Las Muertes Más Bellas del Mundo, is a production by Kiki Avilés and the Yellow House Collective. So it's a collaborative effort that actually has been in the works for some time now. Probably the conceptualization of it happened way before the pandemic because, you know, Kiki has been talking about El Salvador, the war, the violence that propelled and set off this great migration to Washington, D.C., which was his own origin story, right, of coming and migrating to Washington, D.C. He kind of parallels the migration of, you know, Salvadoreños in 1980, which is the official start of the war in terms of, you know, the way that the genealogy gets dated. So the movie is the story of Kinka's migration, but also the story of the community that immigrated to Washington, D.C. and told through the eyes of Kinka Avilés, but also four other artists. So again, it's a collective testimonial of this migration and in different episodes, but it really focuses on Kinka's dealing with ghosts from the past, and hence the title, Las Muertes Más Bellas del Mundo.
Hugo Najera, your response.
Just listening what Ana Patricia is saying, you captured the journey pretty well. It's about 5 years in the making. It's a culmination of a lot of ideas. Kiki Avilés, who is the, you would say, the principal portrait or the principal person that's, you know, the thread that's carrying the portraits of the other artists throughout the film. This is another incarnation of an idea that he's had for a long time. I began working with him about 10 years ago for a piece that he did, a performance piece called 30 Years and Still Running. And this film was intended at first to be a manifestation of 40 years in running, but over the course of the creativity and the voices and the interviews of the artists that the production team collected, it metamorphosized into what you're going to see on September 18th over at Gala Hispanic Theater, which is the first time we're going to be seeing it to a public audience. So we're very excited about it. Sold out show. So it's a very strong declaration of the community's support. And it's a lot of effort on that very special night. So yeah, very good.
You know, we're really amazed at the reception the film is already getting without it being out in the world. So as my colleague Hugo said, you know, it's sold out at the Gala Theater, September 18th, which is the world premiere of this film, long awaited by community and, you know, and just, you know, people that are so interested in the Salvadoran migration story. So we have also scheduled a second screening right on the heels of, you know, the Gala Theater sold out show at the University of Maryland, College Park. Mm-hmm. And that screening will be October the 10th. From 6 to 9 p.m. at the Edward St. John Hall, which is this beautiful new building. And we're hoping to reach out to community. It's open to the public and it's free, first come, first serve, because we have limited space. But we are really enthused that, you know, we have a lot of students that are of Central American and Salvadoran heritage at UMD. So I'm already hearing and seeing the excitement of people that are going to come out to see it, the young people, the community, and we hope to bring everybody together. And we're going to have the presence of artists like Hugo, as well as one of the consulting scholars, Dr. Jose Centeno Melendez, who's going to be talking about the production and also the research that he contributed to this effort.
Yeah, Jose has done fantastic work in archiving the Salvadoran history here in Washington. And I've also had the pleasure, for those who may not know, by the way, Kiki Avilés is a well-known Salvadoran poet and artist in the community in Mount Pleasant in Columbia Heights. And I actually had the pleasure of speaking with him back in 2021 on the 30th anniversary of the uprising in Mount Pleasant. And it's one of those shows, and I feel like I'm heading in that direction already, that we're going to make a lot of references that people may not necessarily know, but within the Salvadoran community, within the Central American community, it's vital and central to the history of the Latino community here in Washington. Now, with that said, we have another clip from Kiki Avilés that gives us more understanding of the film. So let's take a listen.
War turned us into artists, and us making art out of war. So it is this specter of death. And there's just this sorrow, this thing, this anger, this frustration, this, you know, feeling like you're choking, no? It kind of like follows you in a way, tempting you somehow. But at the same time, I think that looming of that monster, the thing that wants to take you away, is the thing that gives you strength to fight back.
So that was another clip from Kike Aviles from the upcoming film, The Most Beautiful Deaths in the World. And this clip in particular perhaps gives us a better idea of the meaning or the concept behind artists in times of war. I want to know, Anna, if you could elaborate on Kike's commentary and perhaps underline the motivation behind the film. I've always been under the firm belief, and a few times that I talked about art and poetry on the show, is that art can be a lie that tells the truth. And I think that may be an underlying motivation here, but please give me your thoughts on this perspective from Kike here.
That's a great way of putting it, a lie that tells the truth, right? Because what fiction is a made-up story about something that might have been true or someone's interpretation of an event, of an incident, something that may be very personal, something that may be collective. So what I think Kike is tapping into in this novel is this long tradition of artists at war, especially in the Central American context. If we think of Central American literature, right, it's a long history of, I like to say, resistance literature, what Barbara Harlow calls resistance literature. Dating back to the Popol Vuh, we have, you know, this magnificent book of the Maya, the sacred book of the Maya that records and references, you know, the existence, pre-existence, the beliefs, but also the coming conquest. There's records of that. So all along in history, there's been literature that has fictionalized the real events that impacted Central America. So we have novels that have to do with dictatorships, El Señor Presidente, a fictionalized, surreal narrative of the impact of authoritarian rule. And throughout, you know, the different phases of literature, we've had protest literature. We've had literature that has protested the United Fruit Company. We have had literature that has depicted and represented the civil wars, testimonial, that, you know, told the story of the people most impacted by the wars. We had poetry that depicted, you know, those wars, express, you know, the impact of those wars. Beyond literature, murals, right? Representation, music, La Nueva Canción, that I think we'll be talking about. And now we have, you know, the literature of migration, of child migrants telling that story. I always like to reference one of my most impactful books, current books, Solito by Javier Zamora, that tells that story of migration. So anyways, this is just giving you a broad brushstroke of this literature of resistance, of which I think Kike Aviles has always written, right? Because he's always written about being set off, his own migration, that bomb that landed in Washington, D.C., that you know, the clip at the beginning refers to. And so he is part of a long tradition of artists that produce out of these critical situations, be it war, be it trauma, be it the impact of, you know, other events. And so he is making fiction out of, you know, real events that have affected a great part of the Central American and Salvadoran community, fictionalized, but based on real truths.
Yes, and that's central right there, because he does what a lot of artists do when discussing tragedies like the Civil War during that time period, which is that he gets his facts straight first and then distorts them at his leisure. But it only works if he does his homework first to the realities of that time period.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is having worked with Kike in previous works as an editor. You know, we did Salvatrucans once again. We did 30 years and it's still running. I've sat with him to talk a lot about these ideas out. And a part of it is that I believe that Kike and many of us are very community minded. And so the notion of a composite, I think, is sort of what I think is he's blending stories of different peoples that he's encountered. There's similarities, there's differences, there's little bits of nuggets of gold in there that he's drawing out. But then all the characters that he portrays in his previous works are characters that many of us are familiar with. You know, these are people that we recognize, that we understand. We know this person. They're sitting in our living room. They're my tía. They're people that we know. And yet it's sort of an interesting filtration that you have, you know, like you're talking about bringing in these historical accounts and conducting lots of interviews. And with this, with Las Muertes Más Bellas del Mundo, there's been a huge ton of archival research behind it. And then this idea of reframing it for fiction, but pulling in from people's real stories. It's relatable. It's caricature, but it's relatable. And a lot of it is from his background also with Teatro Campesino. And I think Latin American entertainment has been full of, I'm saying this in a nice way, like clowns and you know, folks that exagerados, you know, like people who are doing gestures because you're attracting a huge range of our comunidad. It's not just for the elites. It's not just for los pobres. It's for el pueblo, up and down the entire scale. And so a lot of the TV shows from, you know, Chapulín Colorado and El Chespirito, all that stuff explains that. It shows that quite a bit. So I think Quique's and the work that we're representing here, not just with him, but the other artists, is a continuation of a long tradition.
And as Quique mentioned in the clip that we played, this is all coming from death and destruction. All this creativity, or at least the inspiration of it, is coming from death and destruction during that time period in not only El Salvador's history, but Washington's history as well. Because these are things that developed the Latino community as we know it today here in Washington. I'm curious to know if either one of you can tell me who came up with the title itself, The Most Beautiful Deaths in the World, because it's a very morbid title, shall we say, but at the same time, it sort of makes sense to what we're discussing here, and it also makes sense to this particular diaspora, mm-hmm. Hugo.
I believe the etymology of the story of the title came from one of Quique's poems himself, and he was amongst the other artists that were interviewed, and I believe that the Yellow House Collective went with it. It was a different title, and I think after seeing some of the interviews and some of the treatments of the film in its previous versions, that phrase just stood out with the collective. And that phrase, after hearing it, the group was like, this has to be the title. And we talked about the level of awkwardness that the title might bring out. And we talked, and there has been discussions about it being a very jarring kind of a title. But I think we are in a position to bring that title up. And I think it's a very strong title, and it's a provocative title. And it summarizes what all the artists are doing in the film, and that juxtaposition of coming to a country where you have opportunity, but under a very violent context, and being able to have a chance to express oneself, but under such huge traumas, and this constant tug of war between these components simultaneous. I wouldn't even call it a tug of war. It's happening at the same time, is sort of where that title comes from, where it lands.
So as I mentioned before, I've had the pleasure of speaking with Quique Aviles here on the show, here on WPFW. And I've seen his work on stage over the years. I've seen his poems, and it's nothing short of thrilling for me to see him on film and doing this type of work. And it only now with this recent film that it dawned on me that, you know, he seems to be following the same spirit or the same path as the famous Salvadoran poet Roque Dalton. As a matter of fact, that's the first artist that came to mind when I saw the trailer for this film, because Roque Dalton's most famous work, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, Professor Rodriguez, is his expression or his interpretation of La Matanza from almost a century ago in El Salvador during the time period of Maximiliano Hernández Martínez. So correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm drawing those parallels there.
No, you are absolutely right. Roque Dalton wrote during, you know, the war and during the Civil War. He died in 74, right? Even before the full-blown war. But Roque Dalton draws from that history of Salvadoran war, Salvadoran abuse, Salvadoran dictatorships, etc. He has his book is based on the life of Miguel Marmol, which is a autobiography or testimonial of someone that was the only survivor, one of the only survivors of La Matanza. And, you know, kind of referencing back to what the title and what Hugo was saying, right? Roque Dalton has a very famous and important short poem where he said that all Salvadorans after La Matanza were born dead. We were born with our dead. I don't know if Quique Wright, you know, alludes to that in that title, but in his writing, Roque Dalton always played with death. He was very morboso, very morbid, right? Very sarcastic. When Hugo says, you know, the clowning, well, there's a certain satiric humor, right, that a lot of artists use to talk about Central American Salvadoran history. So I think Inca is also in that long tradition, right, of satire, of tragic comedy, where both things coincide because that's what life is, right? Some happiness, some tragedy, right? And so those things come together to make up our life.
Yeah, he even says it in the film, like, we lost our country altogether. That diaspora, that generation lost their country. And I think to a certain degree, and I think we can mention this later on in the conversation, that the further along the generations get separated from that time period, the more they sort of lose not only their country, but their own neighborhood along the way as well. And I bring that up because as we have this conversation this week, it just so happens that the Adams Morgan Day Festival was this past weekend. And amid all the artists that were selling all sorts of fantastic artwork, there was one photographer selling photos of what Adams Morgan, Mount Pleasant, and Columbia Heights used to look like. And I bring this up because gentrification and lack of affordable housing has completely transformed those neighborhoods, and it's an ongoing issue for the city as a whole. There's a lot of old photos in the film as well of what these neighborhoods used to look like. Even Quique himself told Hola Cultura earlier this year that, quote, Salvadorians play integral roles in the city's infrastructure, yet they are often excluded from reaping those benefits. Despite contributing to the construction and maintenance of upscale developments, many Salvadorans cannot afford to live in them. So this goes out to the both of you. To what degree would you measure the issue of gentrification in the film? If not directly, perhaps underlying some of the things that's discussed here.
A good question. I'm just thinking about the interviews and the pieces that you're going to see in the film. And I think a lot of it is contextualized early on with archival footage and archival photos and things in that. But then when you listen to the artists are speaking very much strongly from a very personal perspective. And so I think it's a specter amongst us, similarly to a death as well. We look back at that time fondly. As much as there was problems back then, there's also, we had so much happy memories of those Festival Latino on 18th and Columbia Road. We had people who went to the same schools together. We all knew each other. We all went to, you know, people's, especially Ica generation, house parties, and everybody knew each other. It seemed like you knew everybody in the street. Everybody can say hi. I remember growing up and, you know, walking with my grandma and my mom and family, and you wouldn't be able to walk straight to the Mercado without stopping five times to talk to somebody. And I think that feeling is sort of, while some folks may, you know, speak on it, but the film, you know, contextualizes it, that, but that specter, that memory, I think, like you're saying, for those of us that know the history, for those of us that were in the community, we know, when I'm listening to Yvonne, when I'm listening to Muriel, what she's thinking about as she's describing recapturing history, or Yvonne just telling us stories about him in high school and in school and sort of making his way into the community. Like, I can smell the city in summer when he tells me those stories in the film, you know, which is a very distinct smell. And a good smell in D.C. in the 80s, and this, you know, just the heat is on the concrete. You can feel it with this, in these conversations as well. So,
and I think the film does a great job of revisiting those spaces in the imagery, right? Because a lot of the scenes are filmed in the community. Like, there's a really beautiful scene on the steps of All Souls Church, which, you know, is one of the churches that is very important in the sanctuary movement. And, you know, did a lot and worked a lot with the community. And so you get as Uwe was saying, this spectral, right? This ghostly presence, because a lot of people, due to gentrification, the high cost of rents, have had to move away from the neighborhood. But as Kike always says, Mount Pleasant, La Mount Pleasant, in particular, I think it's 15 and is it 16th and Irving, as the epicenter of the Salvadoran community, right? And people come back. People come back to eat at Ercilia's and the other restaurants along Mount Pleasant. So gentrification has pushed out people, but we come back. We come back to eat. We come back to buy groceries. We come back to the laundromat, whatnot, right? So we need to, you know, gather our ghosts, right? Because, you know, they live with us.
Yeah, gentrification can sometimes be this odd form of erasure and curation at the same time. So it's become safer, shall we say. You know, as Ugo mentioned, there were some hard times during that time period in the 70s and 80s, and we survived it. But the frustrating part, and I think Kike sort of alluded to this in his interview with Ola Cultura earlier this year, is that now we're not there for the good times as present times are today. And that's because of gentrification. And I guess that also sort of lends itself to the urgency of the film as well, because the erasure is real as far as how quickly all these things get forgotten and how gentrification sort of erases the history as it just chugs forward without looking back. And that lends itself to more importance to the film as well. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Ana Patricia Rodriguez, who's an associate professor of U.S. Latinx and Central American Literatures and the School of Languages, Literatures, and Cultures at the University of Maryland in College Park. And we're also speaking with Hugo Najera, who's a member of the Yellow House Collective, as well as being a composer and producer to the film The Most Beautiful Deaths in the World. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Ay. Necesito parar. Ay. Quisiera vestirme de valentía, no sentirme tan adolorida y que no fuera en mi rostro el dolor tan evidente. Ay, ay, tengo hambre. Tengo nada. Ayuda. Ay, siento un frío bien feo con este viento tan fuerte que la cara me revienta. O seguiremos en México. Ay, es tan oscuro que no se distingue nada. Los pies me duelen tanto, tanto. No puedo caminar más rápido. Y por más que caminamos, siente como si nunca vas a más.
That was Francisca Tapia, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone, you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about artists in times of war. In the lead up to the new film, The Most Beautiful Deaths in the World, Los Muertes Más Bellas del Mundo, with Ana Patricia Rodriguez, who's an associate professor of U.S. Latinx and Central American Literatures and the School of Languages, Literatures, and Cultures at the University of Maryland in College Park. And we're also joined by Hugo Najera, who's a member of the Yellow House Collective, as well as being a composer and producer to the film as well. So I would like to turn our attention to the importance of musicians in the film, Hugo. And what was the thought process behind the music that was selected, composed, and if you tried to follow sort of the spirit of the Nueva Canción movement for the film?
Yeah, we have, the film features several art, you know, musicians and artists and folks, including Ivan Navas, who's a percussionist, saxophone player. He's been involved with the community for many years as a teacher and for young people in the city. We have Arlino Lilito, who is part of Mache Tres, who is the son of Lilo Gonzalez as well, who's so family tradition. And Lilo, I would say his father would be characterized as the classic counterculture, 70s counterculture musician, folk, Latino folk music. But then Lilo Lilito moved into the more modern genres of punk music and rock and roll, and a lot of his work through Mache Tres captures a lot of exploring of feelings and identity, and pieces of the Salvadorian diaspora is kind of manifested in a lot of the music that is represented there. So you're going to see a lot of original work. You're going to see a lot of musicians of the community represented there. The music for the film itself that I had the pleasure and honor and privilege of producing for, it's much more laid out as a traditional soundtrack music, backgrounds music, ambient music, music that will complement interviews and segues. But I've been producing music, and I've been a DJ, particularly with Latino, Global South, transcultural diaspora for over 10 years now. So a lot of my musical motivation is rooted within expressing ourselves from the non-Western, from the Global South diaspora. And with this particular project, because of the type of artists that are featured in the film, because it is just as much an identity of Washington, D.C., as it is an identity of Salvadoreños, and then you put the intersection of those two together, I am a product of this community. And I grew up listening to cumbia, I grew up listening to merengue, I grew up listening to salsa, but I'm also into modern musics and new tropical alternative, classical, you know, reggaeton and hip hop and dance music. And the music that we put together for this film was me trying to capture that fusion and bringing it out. So a lot of the music that you're going to hear from the film is a fusion of cumbia, influences of go-go, influences of hip hop, influences of different types of Afro-Cuban rhythms. Are what they may not necessarily be there explicitly, but they were grounded in the creation of the music. So a lot of it is, as much as it's ambient or less of it's instrumental music, there's a lot of thought and a lot of, similarly, a lot of expression in that work as well. So I jokingly call myself the invisible sixth artist of the movie. That's because of the music that's represented there. And as a Latino, and Ana Patricia, Professor Rodriguez knows this, is that I'm addressing the invisibility of our diaspora as well. The music in the film is no different in it being an extension of that declaration of identity too. So,
and all the music genres that you just mentioned is just a reflection of music that was played and listened to during that time period in the late 70s and early 80s here in Washington. I'm so glad that you mentioned Mache Tres, because when I started out here as a college intern here on WPFW, my first like real report was on Mache Tres back in 2004. So I'm glad that they're included here. Yep. In this expression of this community and why they're so important as well with regards to oral history, not just music history, but oral history as well. And this is what I enjoy so much about La Nueva Canción movement, is that, you know, they are sort of doing the same thing that the film is doing, which is creating art out of death and destruction. Lilo and his son have certainly done that, but they're also not, you know, singing songs about the good times. You know, nobody's singing songs about Dabuisson or Duarte. They're not putting those people on a pedestal, and for good reason, because artists, as I said before, is a lie that tells the truth. So I want to continue here this conversation, Anna, with the importance of music. Because as I said before, everything that Hugo just mentioned is a reflection of the music that was played during that time period, and also is another reflection of the sense of urgency in the film in preserving these memories. Because unfortunately, in El Salvador itself, we're living through a time of anti-history, and we have the ability as artists, well, you guys have the ability as artists to preserve history against this tide of anti-history that we've seen within the diaspora, unfortunately.
Yes, I think a film like this one does fill in gaps that especially happen in migration and through intergenerational trauma. Because what trauma does, right, is create a hole where history should be. And so in order to survive, a lot of people, right, either don't talk about the history, like parents, you know, describing what they might have experienced to their children. So I think Kike's film, along with what they call post-memory texts, that are texts of where people did not firsthand have the experience of war, yet they've inherited the trauma, but they've inherited through silence and invisibility. I think what a film like this is doing is recalling through metaphors, right? And also through sounds, through the feelings, through the affect that people experience, and kind of, you know, putting an image on, you know, what we remained unnamed. So this film ultimately is about filling those gaps, but also about intergenerational connections where, right, you mentioned Lilo and Lilito, they partake of different genres, and yet, right, they have an inheritance, which is, you know, the Civil War that pushed them to immigrate. And yet they're able to express those experiences and memories through different musical forms. Lilo Gonzalez through, you know, Nueva Canción, the more traditional period music, and his son through, you know, a more, you know, punk or metal or whatnot, right, in this context. The new generations express it in different ways. So sometimes we don't have the language, but music fills that gap, right, that makes you feel, that makes you fill those gaps that maybe may lead to some healing, we hope. And that's what music does. And I think it's worth mentioning, too, that dance is represented in the film. We have Edwin Aparicio, who is a flamenco queer dancer, and he beautifully represents through bodily movement, right, identities and the stories that he tells. I think he did a production of La Matanza at some point through flamenco. So telling history through these different genres and forms is really so important in this film.
You brought up a very important point of healing with regards to whatever trauma that the film brings up, because there's numerous examples of that in the film during that time period and with this particular diaspora. It's important because we have to remind ourselves that, you know, while Lilo and his son have music as a way to heal or to deal with trauma, and as academics and as artists have the capacity to study history as a means to heal and to understand this trauma that took place in the past, we have to remind ourselves that not everyone has that gift or that capacity to do the same thing or the strength to do it as well. And hopefully the audience that watches this is those people that can realize that they're not alone, at the very least, not alone in whatever trauma they had during that time period. And that community is still out there. And we have to remind ourselves that this is one of the largest Salvadoran communities in the country as well, as a result. Now, it wouldn't seem right to have this conversation without mentioning that there is a genocide taking place in real time, half the world away in Gaza. And as that tragedy continues to unfold, who knows if the next great artist or musician will come from the ashes of that catastrophe. I believe Kike mentioned in the film that sometimes the greatest creativity can come from injustice. So I'm directing this to the both of you, but are there lessons or parallels that people can take from this film that go beyond DC, that go beyond the Salvadoran community, that go beyond this particular diaspora in this particular part of the country?
I think it's an unfortunate situation that I see what we're doing through this film be manifestations of it happening to people in like Sudan, people in Haiti, people in Gaza. It's in a very unfortunate reality that there is a level of relatability to all of this. You know, Salvadoreño's presence in DC and in most parts of this country has been for the majority part a result of US foreign intervention and US foreign policy being put onto us in the 70s and 80s during the Cold War and what have you. And so to see this kind of this infusion of superpowers forcing people out of their homes, separating families, killing people is just, my heart's sad just even saying this on the show, that this is being repeated again. So I think there is a huge amount of unfortunate relatability in terms of what people are expressing and the themes that were being brought up through the film as far as the erasure of history, the closing of people's mouths, not wanting to pass the history over to their children out of a sense of safety, and the double-edged sword that produces for us as a community, that we're making these movies now and declaring ourselves now, is due to a lot of this, the jolt of what violence does to people and the traumas that people do to survive just for the next year, just for the next month, just for the next day. And I think it's an unfortunate similarity that's happening right now.
Yeah, I agree with Uwe. And I think out of that jolt, out of that fire also can come things like solidarity, like aligning with, you know, movements that, you know, protest the violence amongst people that have experienced genocide. I'm thinking again, La Matanza, 1932 in El Salvador, where, you know, virtually the indigenous community was killed, or, you know, they were repressed to the point that they had to go underground with their practices. But then again, you know, we think of Guatemala, where, you know, over 200,000 people were killed, you know, because of U.S. intervention, right? The 1954 war that began in that year. And then we think of, you know, the present moment in Central America, right? Where, you know, we've kind of reverted to, you know, fascist state. And so this is a worldwide movement where certain powers are, you know, oppressing and repressing, and the killing continues. So it is also an opportunity to have these conversations. And I'm sure at the screening at Gala Theater on September 18th, there's going to be a Q&A at the end where, you know, it presents an opportunity where we can discuss. And I love that Hugo says relatability, right? An unfortunate relatability that, you know, we're here again in a moment of genocide. And yet we can't even call it that, right? The prohibition to call Gaza a genocide is just extremely appalling. But the same thing happened to El Salvador, right? Where millions of dollars were handed over to the government on a daily basis to kill people. Right. And so, again, this gets repeated and there is an unfortunate relatability to all this.
In the coming weeks ahead, I'm planning to have one of the people from the NACLA report here on the show to discuss the growing solidarity between Gaza and Latin America, because amongst us, the three of us in this conversation, three Central Americans speaking about the parallels and solidarity with Gaza is one thing. To see the Palestinian diaspora in Chile do the same thing, it starts to add up. And when you see people from Colombia and Puerto Rico doing the same thing, now we have a theory. Now we have a general understanding of the global South, in this case, Latin America, seeing parallels and solidarity with people of Gaza. And it brings up something that I mentioned just a second ago with regards to the film, is for people to recognize, for those who don't have the musical gifts or the academic gifts, or even having a radio show to have these conversations, is the recognition that those people who have gone through that same trauma are not alone at all. And hopefully the film reflects that as well. So we have about 5 minutes left here. And so I want to get something from both of you guys as to what else do you hope people learn from this film, and what other parallels can we draw here? What other forms of artistic expression can we draw from this? I can tell you one thing that doesn't get mentioned often enough is that I've done plenty of shows with regards to all sorts of revolutionary heroes in Latin America, from Oscar Romero all the way down to the Patagonia. And one figure, three figures that don't get mentioned often enough are the Mirabal sisters of the Dominican Republic, who held the feet to the fire of the dictatorship of the U.S.-supported Rafael Trujillo administration in the Dominican Republic. They, like a lot of revolutionaries, were murdered by the state. And in response, what the Dominican people did years later is that they took this obelisk in the capital, Santo Domingo, that was initially dedicated to the dictatorship of Trujillo, and turned it into a memorial for the Mirabal sisters instead. And so I bring that up because that's sort of the power that art can do in the face of dictatorship and in the face of state violence. So that's one of the lessons that I took here. What other lessons do you hope people take from this film as it comes out?
It's a really good question. My go-to gut response would be something very declarative and very idealistic and existential in nature. But I also think that the stories you're going to hear are very stories that feel very familiar. And I like what you were saying earlier about having these stories put into spaces that are not necessarily in academic halls and in, you know, music performance spaces. And I remember a story about Roque Velte. My grandfather used to tell me he used to deliver mail for Roque back in the day. And he would show up to the Las Cantinas and sit and have a conversation with folks. My grandfather knew him as a guy, you know, as a normal person. And this person is the laureate of our people. And my grandfather related to him. My grandfather was a taxi cab driver, you know, hang out with him. And I think
really
what you brought up is something that I think is very much for me as a firstborn in this country, hearing, you know, receiving the stories from my family is something that I begin to identify as a Salvadoreño artistic cultural trait, is that my favorite Salvadoreño artists are people that are artists and creatives, but they hang out with people. They hang out. Kike is a good example. Kike, it has connected so many people from across the cross of our community. Professor Rodriguez here and myself and younger artist, and he was also the director of Paso Nuevo, which is like a youth theater group. So that ability to fit in all these different spaces, I think is something, and spaces where regular people can come in and relate to. One of the things that Kike's work and many of the artists that you see here is that the accents, the relatability, the caliche of our community coming through as literature. And that right there is something that I think captures that as well. So I would say the large lesson is, I like your advocacy of this work being able to fit in all types of spaces, especially those that aren't in these regimented diasporic kinds of ways, you know? So I appreciate that a lot.
Absolutely. And Anna, before you respond, I just want to say that I'm so happy that we could have this long a conversation between three Central Americans and not have anything to say or anything to do with gang violence or whatever stereotype that's foisted upon Central Americans at all whatsoever. So Anna, I'll give you the last word.
Thank you for saying that. I think that, and also piggybacking on what Hugo said, right? The everydayness, the everyday invisibilized people that, you know, you meet in the corner, that you see working, that you see going on the bus, right, that never get recognized. I think, you know, those are the people that have built in great part Washington, D.C., that daily labor, right, doing all these things, just ride the S2 at 10 o'clock, full of people going home, right? That's, you know, I've been there, right? And you see how, you know, yes, they're coming, you know, home from work, but there's also a joy. People will be talking, people will have music and whatnot, right? So I think Kike captures that about, you know, the diaspora, the Salvadoran diaspora in D.C. So that's one important takeaway for me from this film. And another thing, too, is that it's a very, again, to use the word relatable, right, and intersectional film, because It's also the story of how Salvadorans inserted themselves in Chocolate City. So the relationships that were built with other communities, right? Black communities, white communities, the multi-diversity that is Washington, D.C., and how Salvadorans, we were also changed by it, right? We are what, from one of Quique's poems, right? Washingtonians, Washingtons, but with that accent, but that Salvadoran accent. So anyways, I think this film does that, and it's an inspiration to see that Quique has been able to vocalize that transformation of Salvadorans and the transformation of D.C. and the intersections with diverse communities. And so I'm, you know, so happy that we know we have the opportunity now to see the film that's going to be out in the world. So again, Gala Theater, September the 18th. But for all those that haven't been able to get tickets for it, we're going to have a second screening. I think it's the second premiere of this film at University of Maryland, the Edward St. John Hall, 6 to 9 p.m., October the 10th, which is a Thursday. And Uva will join us, also Dr. Jose Centeno Melendez. And, you know, I'm thinking perhaps Quique Avilés will join us. But it's going to be a space for us to share and talk about the film. We're going to have a dialogue. And so everyone is invited.
And with that said, we've been speaking with Ana Patricia Rodriguez, who's an associate professor of U.S. Latinx and Central American Literatures and the School of Languages, Literatures, and Cultures at the University of Maryland in College Park. Ana, as always, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And also, we've been joined by Hugo Najera, who's a member of the Yellow House Collective and a composer and producer to the film The Most Beautiful Deaths in the World. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you for being with us, Hugo Najera.
Thank you. This is very, very, very honorable to be here. Thank you very much.
Fantastic. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. That is at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Russia expelled 6 British diplomats today for espionage, a move the UK called, quote, completely baseless. The expulsions come weeks after the UK expelled a Russian diplomatic staffer, and as British Prime Minister Keir Starmer visits Washington for talks including on Ukraine's use of long-range Western weaponry. Ukraine has been urging the US, UK, and other allies to allow it to use donated weapons to strike further into Russian territory, something Russian President Vladimir Putin said would be tantamount to a declaration of war. In announcing today's diplomatic expulsions, the Russian Federal Security Service said it had evidence the British personnel were from a unit, quote, whose main task is to inflict a strategic defeat on our country, end quote. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Zelensky said today that Russian forces launched a counterattack in the Kursk region to uproot Ukrainian troops who captured territory there 5 weeks ago. Russia's defense ministry said its troops have retaken 10 settlements. The government of Mexico is expected to implement a controversial judicial reform this weekend after the measure passed the Mexican Congress Wednesday and was ratified by a majority of state legislatures yesterday. President López Obrador said he will sign and publish the constitutional revision on Sunday. The reform faces fierce opposition, and protesters stormed the Mexican Senate as it voted on the bill this week. At least one person was injured in the unrest at the Senate. Critics say the bill, which would require judges to stand for election, would damage judicial independence and politicize the country's courts. López Obrador and his successor, President-elect Claudia Sheinbaum, have defended the reform as necessary to curtail corruption in the courts. The U.S. government yesterday imposed sanctions on 16 Venezuelans associated with President Nicolas Maduro, accusing them of obstructing a July election and committing human rights abuses. These sanctioned individuals include the leader of the country's top court, a handful of prosecutors, and leaders of security services. The sanctions come amid a political dispute between Maduro and Venezuela's political opposition, both of which claimed victory in the July election. Opposition candidate Edmundo González fled to Spain this week, days after a Venezuelan judge issued an arrest warrant for crimes including conspiracy and falsifying documents. UN experts have said election results announced by Maduro's government are not credible. Vote tally sheets released by the opposition show González beating Maduro by a wide margin. In domestic news, Boeing aircraft assembly workers kicked off a strike this morning at factories in Seattle and elsewhere across the country after union members rejected a contract offer from the company. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers said late last night that nearly 95% of workers voted to reject the contract and 96% approved a work stoppage. The strike involves 33,000 Boeing machinists, mostly in Washington state. The strike won't directly impact flight schedules or passengers, but it could levy financial and reputational harm on Boeing as it grapples with a year of technical and safety mistakes. A prolonged strike in 2008 cost Boeing about $100 million per day. In a statement, Boeing said it was ready to return to the bargaining table and that it is committed to, quote, resetting our relationship with our employees and the union, end quote. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 75 degrees and overcast. In New York City, 77 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.